From talk to music, from Johannesburg to Israel, from sport to business, this is 101.9 High FM.
101.9 High FM, I'm Benji Shulman and this is the New Blue Review. Welcome to the program. And as I said during the break, we're talking today about the issue of people who are being wrongfully convicted in our criminal justice system and some of the horrific effects that it is taking on the population of South Africa. By the way, if you want to be part of the show, you can SMS us 34519, 061-895-1019. That's the WhatsApp line. And if you want any questions on the story, Carolyn Raffaele, she is a senior journalist at the WITS Justice Project, and Thembakile Morotse, who is an exoneree, are in the studio today, and they're going to be talking to us about their story. Guys, welcome to High FM. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Hi, Benji. Thanks.
My name is Benji, meaning to your listeners.
Yeah, thank you for coming out and early on a Monday morning to chat to us. Thembakile, perhaps let's start with you because you are the person who had this experience. Can you give us a bit of a background? You were arrested, and can you give us a bit of background what you did and what were the circumstances of this arrest?
Well, I won't say taxi driving was my career. In 2004, I was transporting people, and then that was the usual way of me getting money. So, and then it happened in 2003, February 18, I was arrested by the police of Harangu. And then when I asked them why they were arresting me, they told me that I've been accused of murdering a policeman. So they took me to the police station, and then I met other co-accused that were unknown to me.
And that's how this entire journey started.
The dilemma started from there.
Sure. Now, Carolyn, you weren't really involved at this stage in the whole thing, but you guys at the WITS Justice Project often deal with these sorts of issues. From what I understand, that already at this stage, some of the evidence against Thembakile was fairly suspect.
There wasn't any evidence.
Right.
So I only got involved in 2013 or 2012, I think. Mm-hmm. And at that stage, his warder called me out of the blue one day, and I'd never been called by a warder. And he said to me that he'd been working for correctional services for 18 years, and during that time, of the many people who said, I didn't do it, and most of the inmates claimed that they were innocent, in inverted commas. He hadn't believed anyone, and Thembakile was the first person who he had believed. And so he asked me to assist him. But he also told me, which was more important to me at the time, that Thembakile had been trying for 8 years to obtain his trial transcripts, without which he couldn't appeal his case. And that's a constitutional right, and every indigent person in this country is entitled to their trial transcripts at no cost.
So I want to get into the trial transcript, because that was just one of many of the flagrant violations of Thembakile's rights in this particular matter. But, yes. But Thembakile, just explain to us the process, right? So they arrested you, and then they put you in a lineup, right?
Okay, let me take you from
Step back.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So after the arrest, the following day, I was charged for murder, a possession of unlicensed firearm, possession of firearm, and robbery. It was 4 counts. So there was nothing found in my possession. And then I went to the magistrate court. I tried to explain that I was arrested with other people that are unknown to me, others I did know them, but they were not my friends. So the magistrate says that was not the court for the trial. I will explain everything in the trial court. So in the trial court, there was nothing that was brought to before the presiding officer. So we were also taken to the ID parade. No one has pointed me. They only pointed 2 co-accused. And then there was nothing that was brought before the court. So the proceedings went on and on. I was granted bail all the time. I attended the proceedings while I was outside. And there was nothing that link me to the crime. There was no witness that testified against me, and then there was no one who had come to can attest everything that I have done regarding the crime. So it happened in 2004, around May. The investigating officer manipulated one of the accused to testify against me, and then everything got fabricated in the court, and then the presiding officer was misled, and then she ended up convicting all of us. We were all seven.
So, I mean, just for listeners know, I mean, Thembekile is not a small person, right?
Yeah.
He's a tall man, he's got a large frame, and yet, despite that, having been put in a lineup, no one
yes.
identified you, there
yes.
was, and but they did identify to other people, but you were never even
identified
at all.
Yes, yes.
And there were actually two identity parades. So,
yes.
And it was the daughter of the policeman who was murdered, who was present at the murder scene, who was doing the pointing outs. So during these two pointing outs, he was not identified. And as you say, he's a giant of a man.
Yes.
So, I mean, why do you think... First of all, why do you think that this police person fabricated this evidence? How did they how did they come to find you in the first place? And why do you think that the presiding officer, you know, was misled into this conviction?
I cannot tell how did the police come and arrest me, because of it is something that happened out of the blue. I was also shocked. Mm-hmm. And the case has a reward too. I don't know who got that reward. And then the presiding officer was misled by the police and the prosecutor. So everything that they told the court, also the court did not believe, but it still convict.
Sure.
Yes.
So give us a bit of a sense then, because once you were convicted,
yes.
what is it like, and where do you, what happens to a murder convicting you in a South African system?
Yes, once the presiding officer says we were guilty, so everything just got shattered, because of I have to move from planet Earth to another planet and go to drown with prisoners, and so it was very terrible. So I could not understand what was happening around me, and then I was forced to read the books of the law, the constitution of our country, the Criminal Procedure Act and everything. I wanted to know how come could the presiding officer found me guilty for something I didn't do. So after I was convicted July 2004, and then I was taken to Odi prison, they took us to CIMEX, where they call it Kosimampuru now, and then where they took us all our clothes off, and then they shocked us with electric shocks, and then they tortured us, and then we were taken to the solitary confinement. It was very terrible. And then in that process of admission in CIMEX, it was disturbing. So I didn't have cell phone, I didn't have laptop, I didn't have nothing, I didn't have resources. I only have papers and pen. I wrote to the office of the president. By that time it was President Becky, requesting for intervention because of I was there for the crime I didn't commit. So I got a reply that the office of the president cannot intervene with the judiciary. They say the judiciary was independent. So if I was not satisfied with my conviction and sentence, I must appeal, and then I can use my private attorney or legal aid. So I requested legal aid to assist me, and then legal aid replied. They say they were in financial constraint. So I had to raise money to get the court records. So from around 2006, my family and other co-accused contributed money so that we can purchase those records. But it was terrible because I've been writing different letters from to government institutions like human rights, like Department of Justice. See Mr. Penuel Maduna, Jeff Radebe, and Bridget Mabanda, all of them have been writing letters, and they were corresponding with me. So in 2008, I was struggling to have the copy of the record so that I can appeal. I could not appeal because of I didn't have anything that can show what has happened during the trial.
Okay, we're just going to stop there just for the moment because we do need to take a break. When we come back, we'll be carrying on with the story.
The best part of your day. At the heart of your community. All the talk. All the music. All the news. Chai FM.
101.9, Chai FM, I'm Benji Shulman, and this is the New Blue Review. We're talking to Carolyn Rafaeli today and Themba Kilemulutsi about his wrongful conviction and what it was like to be swallowed into the South African prison system. Now, Carolyn, I want to talk to you in a second about, because we're talking about this issue of the transcript that came up, but, you know, you kind of glossed over it, Themba Kile, the idea that when people get put into prison in South Africa. CMAX is very famous in South Africa for being like the high security prison. But you're talking about being tortured. You're talking about solitary confinement. Is that still something that happens in a South African prison? You know, why were the warders doing things like that?
I cannot understand because of I was just convicted and then I didn't do anything wrong inside prison because of CMAX. And Cockstars were made for those notorious prisoners that were trying to escape the gangsters. So I was just convicted and taken to CMEX. So I could not understand why I was tortured. You see.
And solitary confinement, how long were you put into solitary confinement?
It was from 2004 until 2008. Because I was also transferred to Cockstars, Embongweni.
And what does that mean? That you just don't get to see anyone for 24 hours a day? Do they let you do exercise? What is
an exercise is only 1 hour.
Okay.
Yes, and then that hour they keep you in a cage. That's where you take an exercise. Then from there they put you back to the cell.
And you never get to see any other people, any other prisoners, nothing?
Do you see them when they pass? And that is all. We meet when we go to exercise. Otherwise, you are locked.
Now, Carolyn, at this point, we're talking now about the transcript, the issue of Themba Kile trying to get it. And this was something already that a problem that you understood. I mean, is this common for you to, you see, you very unusual for you to get warders, but does the Wits Justice Project work with people who have been wrongfully convicted?
Yes, actually, that's our current focus. When the project started, we were inspired by the innocence movement in America, which was established to try and get people off death row using DNA evidence, and also by, and today there's 69 innocence projects in America which do just that, although most of them have a broader remit today. And they just look at wrongful convictions. Some of them look at only trying to use DNA evidence. And we were also inspired by a project at Northwestern University in Chicago, which is a journalism justice project and not a legal project. So both of those projects look at wrongful convictions only.
So what decided you to then take on Themba Kile's case? You get called from a warder at some random part of the day. Why did you decide that this was something that you guys would get involved with?
So we get a lot of, the project receives a lot of calls from family members, from inmates, and very occasionally from prison officials, but this was the first time a warder had ever called me and said, I believe this man is innocent. So that was really a big red flag for me. And also then when I didn't decide to take on the case because he said that he believed Themba Kile was innocent, I actually decided to investigate it because of the transcript issue, because that's a human rights problem. And so I went, also journalists aren't allowed in prisons, and this warder offered to organize a visit for me. So that was an added bonus because it's very problematic in our work, access. And so I went there to, and I met Thembekile, and although I had a gut instinct that I believed he was innocent or not guilty, exculpatory evidence, to find that you can't rely on your gut. So anyway, I agreed to take on the case in terms of first looking for the transcripts, which were the most important, you know, thing for him at the time. He couldn't move anyway without the transcripts.
So Thembekile, by this point, you had, no basis background in law. You were basically reading up all the stuff yourself.
Yes.
And you had raised the money for the transcripts.
Yes.
But they were incomplete. They didn't actually help you.
So in, let me proceed. So in 2008, in fact, when I inquire regarding the transcript, from the transcribers, I was told that they were busy correcting them. So in fact, they were taken from transcribers to the registrar's office, back from the registrar's office to the transcribers. They were taken just like this. So I also engage again the Minister of Justice, and then they engage with them. They were telling them that the delay was unacceptable. Then around late in 2008, I got a copy of the record. So when I perused, I found that essential part was omitted. I had to complain again and told them that this record was not authentic because of, there is nowhere where I am talking, and then I cannot prove to the appeal court that I am innocent. So in 2009, our struggle, 10, 11, until I read an article in the Sunday Times about those two guys that spent 19 years in prison, how they were helped by the Vest Justice Project. And then I started to know about what is Vest Justice Project. I told the warder, and then the warder contacted the Vest Justice Project, and then the warder found Sister Caroline. And then when Sister Caroline came to consult with me, she just found me with a lot of correspondences from different departments and voluminous trial transcript that was not authentic. So I had to give her and check and check and check, and then she also engaged the human rights lawyers, and then she helped me in around 2012 the record until it was retranscribed. And then in 2012 late, we went to court requesting for appeal. It was granted, and then
I want to stop you there before we get to the appeal, right?
All right.
So in this, Caroline, you're saying to get a transcript is a basic human right, transcript of your trial. So how long by that point had it then taken you, because not only had you had to raise money to get it retranscribed, but then you say the court actually had to order the retranscription. So how long had that process taken?
Since I purchased.
Since you started trying to get the transcript.
Almost 8 years.
So basically, it took you 8 years in prison in these horrific conditions just to get to basically the starting point before you could make an appeal.
Yes.
Sure. That's
it's terrible.
It must. How did you keep on going this whole time just to even get the transcript?
I was praying, and then I was nagging the departments. Mm-hmm. Yes, I was irritating them.
Okay, so you had the transcript at this time, Caroline. You were involved as well with having help. Now and now you've done the appeal. So appeal means that you can go to the Supreme Court of Appeals to look at to look at the evidence. What was the outcome of that?
So I requested to appeal. The appeal was granted, and then I went to the full bench. The full bench dismissed my appeal. They say, even though they said the witness was a reckless liar, but still they dismissed. And then I went to the Supreme Court of Appeal. They also dismissed. And then I went to the Constitutional Court alone, and then they also dismissed.
I think it's important to point out that Thembekile, after he had lodged his appeal in the Supreme Court with the help of legal aid lawyers, after that they said they couldn't assist him any further. And he then engaged a fellow inmate, I think he was a former prosecutor, to draft an appeal to the Concord.
Yes.
And then that was dismissed as well on the basis that it wasn't based on any constitutional principle and that it had no reasonable prospects of success.
So in other words, you had now done the whole gamut of our legal system. You've gone to the High Court.
Exhausted all avenues.
And how long did that take? Because in my experience, these appeals can take a while.
Yes, by that time it was 2013.
So it was another 2 or 3 years down the line before the Concord.
Yes.
So basically, I mean, by that point, you must have felt like you were out of options. Like there didn't seem to be any other avenues, right?
Yes, there was no avenues, but I was optimistic that one day I will get out. Though the avenues were exhausted, by now my only option was to write a full petition letter to the judge president to tell him that my matter was not taken to consideration because of this, that and that.
Actually, the reality is that after the Constitutional Court has dismissed your appeal, you're done, and the only further avenue is a presidential pardon, the application for a presidential pardon. And as far as we know, there haven't been any presidential pardons granted in democratic South Africa.
So that was kind of it. You had to. That must have been devastating. I can't imagine what it must have felt like to know that you were sort of out of options.
Yes, it was devastating, but I was optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I kept my faith alive.
What was remarkable then was that the story took a new turn, because it was you had sort of inspired the other people in the prison to start their own processes. So tell us a little bit about what was that interaction like.
I was helping them regarding their complaints in court proceedings. And then
this was your co-accused, the ones that were other people that were convicted.
Besides my co-accused, the other inmates, I was helping them.
Okay.
And then my co-accused, I also helped them. So the two co-accused that filed the appeal in the Constitutional Court was first released before me.
Okay.
The two that filed their appeal after him.
Yes.
Because they, Boswell Mshlongo and Disco and Corsi, their appeal was also framed by a prison lawyer, and actually it was framed on a constitutional principle.
Okay.
It was based on a constitutional principle. And then what was a story of great serendipity or the finger of God or something absolutely extraordinary or a miracle, because their appeal was successful. And during the course of that appeal, the state prosecutor, a man called Nigel Carpenter, suddenly announced to the court that there's no evidence to convict Boswell and Disco, and that accused number 5, whose name they never gave, should receive the same legal fate as the other two. And the court then agreed to appoint the same pro bono lawyer, attorney advocate that was acting for them, to represent Themba Kiele, accused number 5, and they hadn't given a name. And a couple of days thereafter, it was discovered that accused number 5 was Themba Kiele, and that triggered a legal principle called res judicata, which means in layman's terms, you can't have two bites of the same cherry.
It's so sort of like, if you always watch it in the American movies, they call it double jeopardy. It's like a similar kind of concept, from what I understand.
Sort of. But so you're done. When your case has been dismissed by the Concord, you're done.
Right.
And you cannot appeal on the same evidence, the same case twice. But I think when the court looked at Boswell and Disco's case and they realized there was no evidence, they overturned Boswell and Disco's wrongful conviction and sentence and released them immediately. They were in prison a little bit longer than 13 years, I think, than Themba Kile, because they had they hadn't got bail initially all those years earlier, and so they had 2 years longer. But anyway, the court overturned their decision, and then they were the court was faced with
A very special circumstance.
Because
Themba Kile's case had sort of been dug up in the process of them dealing with the other cases.
Yeah, and so he languished in prison for another 3 months while the court had to decide
if it was going to admit that it got it wrong.
If they actually had the jurisdiction to hear this case again because of this legal principle of res judicata. And so it was kind of touch and go. And then eventually, after 3 months, the court decided that in the interests of justice, that they had to overturn his conviction and sentence and release him. And I have to say that about 3 weeks before his release, I was climbing the walls, and I'd waited a long time to write the story at his request, which didn't suit me, but anyway. And I went to visit him in prison about 3 weeks before his release. And he told me, just calm down, be patient. He was telling me to be patient after he had been behind bars for 11 years.
Well, I mean, that's what literally was going to be my next question, you know. How do you deal with the frustration, of first of all, like the slowness of the process, and then of the kind of explosive points? You sort of, there's a long waiting period, and then all of a sudden you're back to square one or having to redo. It must take quite a personality.
Yes, it's true. I have made peace that the wheels of justice is grinding very slowly, and when you are behind bars, that your time is not working like the outside time, so you have to go at the snail pace. So whether they will respond, they will respond at their time, but as long as you will get a response, that is positive. Because of me, I've been disappointed many times. I got very evasive response from departments and from people that were supposed to help me, and others were reluctant to assist me.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be back talking to Themba Kile and Carolyn.
Stay relevant and up to date. Keep informed. This is 101.9 High FM.
101.9 High FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is the New Blue Review. We're talking today to Carolyn Rafaeli from the Vits Justice Project and Themba Kile Moraotsi, who is an exoneree, and we're hearing the story about how he managed after 11 years to get out of jail. If you want to be part of the conversation, please SMS us 34519, or you can WhatsApp us on 061-895-1019. Themba Kile, in this entire time that you were fighting with the criminal justice system to help get you out, what happened to your family while this was going on?
My family was distracted, and then my son was raised without a father figure.
How often were they allowed to visit you? How does that kind of process work?
In CMEX, so I was not allowed to get visit. It was only once a month.
And is that like, are you allowed to touch one another? Is it through a telephone? How does that work?
No, my son, when they bring him to the visit, he touched me through the glass, and then that tortured me too much. And then I had to write to the social worker requesting for the contact visit.
Was that eventually granted?
Yes, it was granted, because it was very disturbing to see a toddler want to touch you.
Mm.
And then you are that side, and then your other hand is locked to the stone chair, and then it was very inhuman and barbaric.
Mm-hmm. So you had now eventually the Concord sort of got its act together. They decided, in the interest of justice, to let you out.
Yes.
So what was that like to finally be free?
Just God's divine intervention, and then to be a free man, it was. Oh, that was a very huge present for me, just to be free.
Mm-hmm.
Just to be free.
for many wrongfully convicted people, I think when one trauma ends, another one begins when they walk out the prison gates, because there's no support for somebody who's been exonerated. There's more support for somebody who has committed a crime and is released on parole. And so you walk out of the prison gates to nothing, to a changed world, and you have to readjust. And also there's no compensation from no financial compensation from the state for all those lost years.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what was it like to just even sleep in your own bed? I know from when I've read Prison of War books, for example, that people find it uncomfortable to sleep in their rooms and that sort of thing. Is that something that you encountered?
No, it's you know, for when you come from inside, you and then you are outside now. You go in phases, because you will not adjust at the same time, because of some mornings when I wake up or think I will be thinking, hey, I must be counted, not forgetting that I was home. So I have to adjust and then go with the phases, but it's a slow pace.
And Carolyn, so there's absolutely no compensation for effectively what was a state-based problem. I mean, it was their issue that they messed up.
The only way in which you can seek compensation is through a civil claim for damages.
Okay. And that's it. That's no basis for it.
Yeah.
And well, is that something that you've been considering, Tamakila?
I'm still on the pipeline. Yes.
Okay. And once you got out, I mean, you were a taxi driver before then. Yes. Is that something that you then took up again?
No. I did not. There's a friend of mine who used to come and visit me. He's in a perfume company. Then he just grabbed me, and then I didn't have to get my CV and look for work. I was very fortunate.
So you were at least able to be employed immediately again after being released?
Yes.
So at least you can feed your family.
Yes.
I want to move away just from the story for a second and ask maybe Carolyn, the whole way along the process, there seems to be all these sorts of gaps in the criminal justice system. And we speak about them all the time. But it's almost as though this case encapsulates all the weaknesses that we're seeing. Everything from the police not doing their jobs properly in terms of investigations, to the problems with evidence, to issues around not having proper legal aid for people. What is your experience that this tells us, this particular case, about the wider systemic issues in the criminal justice system in general?
I think it does encapsulate many of these issues. In America, there's something called the National Registry of Exonerations, which tabulates all wrongful convictions since 1989. And analyzing that data, they've come up with five major causes of wrongful convictions, which are false confessions or coerced confessions, which...
was clearly a case, part of the case here.
No, Tembekile didn't make a false confession.
From the other person.
But sometimes accused people who are tortured, that's a major cause of coerced confessions.
Okay.
And it happened to one of his other co-accused. So I'm looking at the broader case.
Okay.
So the false confessions, false accusations or perjury, so he was subjected to false accusations, false or misleading forensic evidence. In his case, there was no forensic evidence implicating him. And then there's official misconduct, which includes poor lawyering, prosecutorial misconduct, and various other things. And there were, I suspect in his case, there was some official misconduct. There was also a bungled police investigation to start with, shoddy detective work, and then eyewitness misidentification, which didn't happen to him, but did happen with his co-accused.
Mm. We have an SMS in here from Yvonne Benetti. She says, "Yeah, Benji, I'm so emotional by this injustice and salute Temba for his inner strength and endurance and pray that God will bless him with abundant quality time with his loved ones now. Blessings to Caroline too." So
thank you so much.
A listener there reaching out to the story of Tim Akile, which I have to say, when I first read it, I thought it was, it touched me. And then I actually went to go listen to the two of you guys speak at Limud in August, and the room was completely packed, and people were, I think, justifiably outraged by your story and also your humility, Tim Akile, South Africans have a history in this country of coming out of jail not angry, and I think that you really do personify that. So
I think Themba Akile is an extraordinary man, and he has the most extraordinary attitude of forgiveness. He has no bitterness at all, and personally I've learned my greatest life lessons from him.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be talking again to Themba Akile.
A frequency like no other. 101.9 High FM.
101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is the New Blue Review. Talking today to Caroline Raffaele, who is a senior journalist at the Vitz Justice Project, and Themba Akile Mulutsi, who is an exoneree. He's sort of like our very own Shawshank Redemption, but he didn't escape. He did it the legal way, so he knows how to do it properly. Themba Akile, I wanted to ask about your time in jail. Did you make friends with anyone? Are you still in contact with any of the co-accused? Like, because I feel like the inmates supported you and you supported them. There was that kind of camaraderie, even though some of them must have been quite dangerous people.
Yes, they were. They are dangerous people. And then I'm just a jolly person. So I like to joke. And then I was preaching behind bars, and then I was helping behind bars. So the gangsters did not victimize me. So instead of victimizing me, they were protecting me. So I have a lot of friends. Even now, I'm still helping those that I believe they are innocent there, because I have an innocent foundation that I have made. In March, I was with Sister Caroline in Memphis on the Innocence Network, and then they inspired me so much. So that's the reason I made my own foundation for the innocent here in South Africa. So I'm still in contact with them, helping them.
Because that is something which I think a lot of people, the stereotype of prison is that once you go into prison, you get attacked, right? Was that never your experience from the beginning?
No. I was only disturbed emotionally, but not scared of everyone, because of I know I was there for the crime I didn't commit, and I did know that one day I will be out. I won't drown and die inside there.
Mm. Carolyn, now, this is something that the Vitz Justice Project has been working on, getting other exonerees out. Talk to us a little bit about what you're trying to do in terms of getting or figuring out if there's other South Africans who are wrongfully convicted.
Wrongful convictions in South Africa is a problem that's often denied and usually unacknowledged. And there's obviously an enormous human cost to judicial error. Mm. And so we've decided... I mentioned the National Registry of Exonerations in America earlier on in this interview. And so we're trying to establish a South African registry of exonerations in order to prove that that this happens and that the judicial system is fallible. We are just in the fundraising stage at the moment. The American registry has, I think at the moment, about 2,900 cases of wrongful convictions registered. And so we are in a process of trying to collect data. And once we've done this, it will give us, I think, a very unique insight into the criminal justice system.
Shouldn't it just like publicly available information? Like when the state exonerates someone, it's on record?
No, because neither the Department of Justice nor the NPA keep records of wrongful convictions. So, excuse me, there are no South African statistics, which is why the problem is usually denied.
How do you go about figuring out then who was wrongfully, who has been exonerated?
It's a huge job, and at the stage we're at now, which is a very, very initial stage, we're sifting through records of successful Supreme Court appeals.
And Temakile, your Innocence Project that you're working on, what kind of stuff are you doing? Is this mainly focused on the people who are still inside?
Yes, to help them get out, to give legal assistance.
The other thing is that the WITS Justice Project is based in the journalism department at WITS. Mm-hmm. So we're essentially an investigative journalism project. We're not lawyers. I'm not a lawyer. I've learned everything I know about the law from Tembekile. He's been a great tutor, I must admit. But so our job is we receive these hundreds of letters and phone calls, and we don't have the resources to take them all on, but the few that we do select, we will investigate those cases, as I did with Tembekile. But the problem is it's such a long, long road. For instance, the Innocence Project, one of the most successful Innocence Projects in the States, the Ohio Innocence Project, they take 79 years to obtain a successful exoneration. So we're a very small team, and we can't take them all on. But our job is really to investigate these cases and then to write about and publish our findings.
So, for example, if someone listening to this is a lawyer, is that the kind of help that would assist you to not necessarily expedite the process, but at least sort of have the information needed to help you to do your work?
Absolutely, because one of our biggest problems is that we're journalists, not lawyers. And in my experience, human rights lawyers don't find criminal work sexy, and criminal lawyers don't find human rights work sexy. So we have to go out and find pro bono lawyers to assist us. And it's a problem.
So if you're listening to this and you are a lawyer, perhaps this is somewhere where you can make a contribution to even one person. If people want more information either on the WITS Justice Project or Tembekile on your Innocence Project, where can they get more info?
For starters, they can Google the WITS Justice Project .co.za, WITSjusticeProject.co.za. It's got a lot of information about wrongful convictions, about our work, which has also involved torture and prison conditions, and all the articles that we've written.
And Temakile?
Mine is www.tif.
.tif?
Yes.
Okay. .co.za.
Yes.
Okay, there we go. Pretty much brings us to the end of the show for today, guys. By the way, if you want to watch a great movie, well, I thought it was a great movie, called The Hurricane, which is about an innocence project in America. I thought it was quite inspiring if you've already watched The Shawshank Redemption. Guys, thank you so much for coming into the show. Temakile, thank you so much for sharing your very difficult story with us. Carolyn, thank you so much for helping out in general, but for coming on the show today. And good luck with all your projects going forward.
Thank you so much. You're welcome.
Thank you so much, Benji, for hosting us.
There we go. We'll be back next week on the New Blue Review. Thanks to everyone who helped put the show together, Mandy, Craig, Vusi, and the team. And we'll see you next week.